Last meeting, we spoke a little on the trumpets that are found in the book of Revelation and went briefly over them, covered the first five. Now, tonight, perhaps we're in a better position, better prepared to review the same five trumpets before we go on again, but bring in some more detail, more information that will help to clarify certain points. And in order to do so, as a basis of our meditation tonight, we'd like to review with you a reading in the Old Testament that is really the background of the account that's found in Revelation. It's a flashback of something that previously happened in Israel's history, which, when reviewed and studied, will throw light as to the significance and the meaning or interpretation of what is found in the book of Revelation. So then we go back to the book of Joshua, the sixth chapter. And there is the account of the overthrow of Jericho. See, I have given into your hand Jericho, with its king and mighty men of valor. This is the American Revised Standard Version I'm reading. You shall march around the city, all the men of war, going around the city once. Thus shalt you do for 6 days. And seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. And on the seventh day, you shall march around the city seven times, the priests blowing the trumpets. And when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, every man straight before him. So Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant, and let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord. And he said to the people, go forward, march around the city. Let the armed men pass on before the Ark of the Lord. And as Joshua had commanded the people, the seven priests, bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord, went forward, blowing the trumpets, with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord following them. And the armed men went before the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the Ark, while the trumpets blew continually. But Joshua commanded the people, you shall not shout, or let your voice be heard, neither shall any word go out of your mouth, until the day that I bid you shout. Then you shall shout. So he caused the Ark of the Lord to compass the city, going about it once. And they came into the camp and spent the night in the camp. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the Ark of the Lord, and the seven priests, bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord, passed on, blowing the trumpets continually. And the armed men went before them, and the rear guards came after the Ark of the Lord, while the trumpets blew continually. And the second day they marched around the city once, and returned unto the camp. So they did for 6 days. On the seventh day, they rose up early at the dawn of day, and marched around the city in the same manner seven times. It was only on that day that they marched around the city seven times. And at the seventh time, when the priests had blown the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, shout, for the Lord hath given you the city. And the city and all that is within it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction. Only Rahab the harlot and all who are with her in her house shall live, because she hid the messengers that we sent. But you keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction, lest when you have devoted them, you take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel a thing of destruction and bring trouble upon it. Now, the study tonight is based on Revelation, the ninth chapter, or eighth and ninth chapters. I think you can see there's a connection between this account in the Old Testament and the one found in Revelation 8-9. Now, there's some things we'd like to review. The first six trumpets are not evil trumpets, and the seventh trumpet, the righteous trumpet, the trumpet of God. We mustn't think of the trumpets from that standpoint, that six are evil trumpets of men and so forth, but the seventh trumpet is the holy trumpet, in contradistinction to the six others. That isn't the thought. All six trumpets are related to messages from the Lord. The only difference is that it's during the blowing of the seventh trumpet that success is attained and the city is destroyed during the sounding of the seventh. We'll notice in the count in Revelation when we read about these seven angels who bear the seven trumpets that they stand in the presence of God. They are messengers or servants of God. In the Old Testament account, the ones who went before the ark blowing the trumpets were seven individuals, seven priests. That harmonizes with the seven individuals that God has used throughout the gospel age in sounding these trumpets. They are priests in a special capacity. We know from the study of the Bible that the trumpet, the silver trumpet, corresponds to the trumpet of truth, silver truth, a message, a proclamation of truth, as it comes from God's Word. Now, the city Jericho in the Old Testament, we believe, is a type of Christendom, that great city, which will fall, which will be destroyed at the end of the age, because of its pretensions to be the Church of God, when in reality the true Church of God is composed of a mixed multitude out of all races and nations and tongues whose names are written in heaven, not on earthly scrolls and not belonging to one particular denomination. But these are bound by a heart union with Christ and with God. And it says that this church rests upon this foundation, namely that the Lord knoweth them that serveth him. That is the tie that binds these Christians in love down through the age, even unbeknownst to one another. So the church has been one family, but separated in one respect, physically speaking, but in heart union with the Lord and bound to one another in sympathy of purpose. We notice something unusual. Each of the 6 days, the people, when they circle the camp, they did it only once, each day for 6 days. On the seventh day, instead of circling the city once, it was circled seven times, which is interesting. We'll come to that a little later, Lord willing. Then another thing stands out, that as they went around the city, there wasn't just the one blast of the trumpet, but there was a continuous din. There was a continuous noise, a continual blowing of the trumpet as they marched about the city. In other words, this message of truth, while it would be first sounded by these messengers and they would die and pass off the scene, that message, that sounding of that message would still continue on until the next day, until the next time that the city was to be circled. In connection with the trumpets in the book of Revelation, we can see that as they are each blown, there is a damaging effect, apparently, in the first. The blessings of truth, from the standpoint as it is shown in other chapters of the book of Revelation, in this particular setting, are slanted from the standpoint of how truth will overturn error. And so we find that as the trumpets are blown, it says the first angel sounded, and the earth was affected. A third of the trees and a third of the earth is burnt up and all the green grass. And then comes another angel and he sounds his trumpet, and the next strata or ground that is affected is the sea. The sea is affected. It says a third of all things that had life in the sea died, and a third of the ships. And then we find next that the realm affected is the rivers and fountains of waters, or springs, and other water, inland waterways, rather than the great ocean. And all of these pictures represent Christendom. In the Bible, the church is sometimes pictured as a professed church of God, is sometimes pictured as sitting on a river, like the great river Euphrates, mystic battlements sitting on the great river Euphrates. Sometimes organized society underneath religious control or restraint is pictured by the earth. And so the earth pictures Christendom, and in others, the sea. Take in Revelation, what is it, the 18th chapter, so when it mentions about the destruction of Babylon, it tells about how that this great system had intercourse with the various nations and gained rich revenues from the trade on the sea that it exploited for its own purposes. And that others who were in harmony with the system, they also profited thereby. But not from the Lord's standpoint. When it tells about the third trumpet sounding, might as well read it, and where the waters are affected, it tells us that there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. These seven trumpets and their blowing correspond to the messages that are given to the seven churches in the first three chapters of the book of Revelation. Remember when it says unto the angel of the church of Ephesus, write, these things saith so-and-so. Then the next church, Smyrna, and so forth, down the line. There were seven churches mentioned there, and there were seven stars or leaders that are chosen by God to give a message of admonition and of encouragement and rebuke and exhortation to the church, the professed church of God. But now, this here lesson tonight in connection with the trumpets is telling about the effect of these same messages as it is seen and viewed by the nominal hosts of Christendom, who do not favorably react to the message of truth. Remember, we read the 45th Psalm, the last lesson, and it tells in that 45th Psalm how that grace was poured into Messiah's lips. He was just full of grace and truth. But when we find that later on, that same grace and truth had the effect of slaying his enemies in the next day. He had a sword on his thigh, and it's with his mouth we're told that the nations are going to be affected in the next days. So the truth has an effect of life unto life, an odor of fragrance, or one of death unto death, depending on the heart in which it is received. In this third message, when it speaks about this star falling from heaven as a lamp, it is an illustration of Satan's fall from heaven. This is viewed from nominal Christendom's standpoint. Arius was a great star in the celestial heavens, a man of great potentiality. But when he espoused the truth and opposed it, held the truth, he began to go into disfavor eventually and became an outcast from Christendom at large. And thus we find that he is viewed as anathema to the present day, both by Protestantism and Catholicism. They think that all heresy had had its real root in Arius' doctrine, which is covered here by the third angel. Actually, those who have studied his life and all see how he has upheld the truth. And it was at that time that the greatest doctrinal errors gained real foothold in the church, professed church of God. the worship of the Virgin Mary and the doctrine of the Trinity and all these things that are really not basically found in the Bible. They're found in other books, but not found in the Bible itself. That they had their start there. And Arius opposed it. Now his fall from heaven was due to them as much as Satan's fall. He was a brilliant light. He was called Lucifer. Son of the morning. How art thou fallen, O Lucifer, son of the morning? And then later on he's called that, isn't he? This angel is found, well, that's in the fifth case where he goes down to the pit. And there's the smoke and a locust plague that comes forth from the pit. What we're trying to illustrate now is this. When Satan was cast from heaven, he did not fall like lightning, as it's generally interpreted in our Bible today. It isn't emphasizing the rapidity of his descent, that he fell or was ejected from heaven as lightning, but it's rather emphasizing that this great, brilliant light fell from heaven. And that the word that's translated lightning in the New Testament might properly be consistently interpreted a bright shining, and not just in Luke, where it mentions about the bright shining of the candle, but even here where it refers to Satan, that it emphasizes the thought that this great bright light fell from heaven, not as lightning, but speed attached. And so we find here a connection with these two lights that fall from heaven, and one is even lightning to Lucifer. The third one is likened to wormwood. It tells us the effect of the descent of that star when it touches the waters, it turns them into wormwood. And it tells that a third of the men dies because of the bitterness of the waters. I'm just reviewing this in a very fast way. Now another thing, in connection with the effects of the trumpets when they were blown, and it says a third of the green things or those things having life died and so forth, it means that the message of truth had an effect upon those individuals in such a manner that they disassociated themselves from the nominal hope or mass of Christians who professed to be Christians but denied him in their everyday life, that it was merely a profession of followers of Christ by name, but really it's being converted and consecrated to the Lord to follow him every hour of the day, every day of the week. Very few would honestly profess that, but yet they call themselves Christians. And so we find that the effect of these messages of truth, it had a separating influence. And those who received the truth generally did it from two motives. It produced either a full, unreserved consecration on their part to God, whereby they disassociated themselves in spirit from Babylon and its ways, or they became dissatisfied and just left the church, but didn't consecrate. But it had the effect of killing them as far as their previous walk was concerned in the course of nominal Christendom are concerned. So we find here that when it mentions, well, we'll come to that a little later, about the sixth trumpet. The number there is pretty high. I think it says 200 million people are involved in that sixth trumpet. And the number of them was two 10,000 times 10,000, or 200 million were involved. And in that sixth trumpet, it wouldn't mean that there were 200 million Christians who espoused the cause of Christianity. Rather, there were 200 million people who espoused at that time the cause of Protestantism, either for political reasons, as a means of escape from oppression and political liberty, that they disassociated themselves from that system for other reasons. And amongst that number, there were a much more minority of those who separated themselves in the proper way. They separated themselves unto the Lord, consecrated to him. But in that big volume of people, 200 million, it did not represent all converts to Christianity. Merely those who were either stout adherents or sympathizers with Protestantism and Lutheranism. That's what it amounted to, the sixth angel. So when we come down to the the sixth, when we came to the fifth, we saw that there was this locust plague, and it described the locusts, what their shape was, and it doesn't give their number, but shows that it was a great host. And it likens that they had the face of a man. That is, the doctrines of the truth were loving, merciful, and very appealing to those who had the proper heart condition. Those who didn't have the proper heart condition, they did sense that with the truth there is a reasonableness attached to it, that there is a mercy and love in that message, and it causes resentment on the part of those that are not in the proper heart condition. And they view this message from an unfavorable standpoint. They view it as a seductive influence, and that the attractiveness of the truth is pictured as woman's hair in connection with these locusts. Beautiful, and they view it as destructive, because when they see these locusts with the woman's hair and the man's face, and really in the true picture these are good qualities, they view it with terror, and that these doctrines are finding great inroads into their system because of their reasonableness and their love and wisdom and power. But now we come to the sixth topic. And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel, which hath the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. This voice from the holy would be divine instruction. It's a message from a holy source, from off of the altar. And it comes to this messenger, and it tells this sixth angel that he does the loosing of the four angels, which is a rather strange thing. Loose thou the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates.
When we read this message concerning these four angels, we find
the 15th verse. And the four angels which were loosed, which were prepared for an hour, a day, a month, a year, for to slay the third part of men. And the number of the army of the horsemen, which were 200,000,000, and I heard the number of them. And thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them, having breastplates of fire, jacinth, brimstone, and the heads of the horses were as the heads of lions. And out of their mouths issued fire, smoke, and brimstone. By these three were the third part of men killed, by the fire, by the smoke, by the brimstone, which issued out of their mouths. Their power is in their mouth and in their tails, for their tails were like unto serpents, and had heads, and with them they do hurt. And the rest of men which were not killed by these plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and of wood, which neither see nor hear nor walk. Neither repented they of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their thefts. In the 15th verse, it tells us that the four angels slay the third part of man. Later on, it indicates it's the horsemen, the horses primarily, upon which the horsemen ride, which do the slaying. So here we have the angel who looses the four angels, and the four angels, and we have the 200 million involved, 2 million horses, 100 million horses, that they do slay. They're all in the picture, they're all related.
We'll come back to that in a minute. You'll notice it's very similar to the fifth trumpet. The description of the horses is, in some respects, very similar. The difference being, instead of having the face of a man and the hair of women, these horses, it doesn't mention that they look like locusts. In the fifth trumpet, the plague there was really primarily a locust plague, and the locusts were arrayed or arranged like horses. But they were basically locusts, with men's faces and women's hair. But in this chapter, it mentions just horses, but having lion's heads. And it shows how the, from their standpoint, how destructive Protestantism seemed to them. It seemed that the adherents of Protestantism just filled the earth and created great fear over Catholicism when they saw this split happen in the church. And yet they couldn't gainsay doctrinally nor otherwise the reformers, because on the greater part they had the better hand. Their breastplates were strong like iron and jacinth, and it tells that this fire, smoke, and brimstone which came out of the horse's mouth, they had confusion of faith when they would try to doctrinally debate these issues with the Protestantism, and they came out the losers. So that they had to resort to other practices, such as the Inquisition. They tried to stifle Protestantism by the institution of the Holy Inquisition, and by that method. Well, that had been done earlier, but it had been followed on later, and they tried to repress the truth movement from Luther's day since, by that, up until the French Revolution, by that means. And it wasn't successful. The fire, smoke, and brimstone. The brimstone is a picture of sulfur. The thought is, in destroying something, such as the Gehenna, the outcast of Jerusalem where they burnt the garbage, or other cities, sometimes sulfur would be added. And it would serve a twofold purpose. It would... It acts as a purifying agent and intensifies the burning in such an extent that when the burning is complete, it's so complete and so purified that it pictures extinction in a very vivid way, a very strong picture of how they viewed the inroads of truth as it came in conflict with the teachings of Catholicism. In this picture, it's different than the previous trumpet in some respects. Take the first trumpet. When it blew, a third part of the earth were affected, a third part of the trees. And it was primarily the Jewish part, the Jewish nation, that was primarily influenced as a whole. That sphere, they remember we pictured about, there is the Jewish element, the Grecian, and the Roman, just like in the cross of Jesus. And it was the Jewish realm that was affected the most. The green grass was an element of the fresh converts to Christianity amongst the Gentile churches. But as yet, Christianity did not make the impression upon these Gentile nations that it later did as the Christianity waxed older. It was a new thing, and this fresh, tender element, the converts in the various classes of the Gentile nations, they were all affected. But this established church in Judea, that was painted as a whole, the nation. Now, when it says the third part is affected, and say it's the Jewish nation, it wouldn't mean that the Jewish nation became Christian. It would mean that from the standpoint of the scribes and Pharisees, they looked upon the doctrine of Jesus as though it had contaminated the whole sphere. Why, they say that this is going out throughout the whole world. And it was enlarged from in their perspective. Actually, it was only a minority of the Jewish leaders and of the commonwealth who really espoused the cause of Christianity in its true sense. But they felt that it had so impregnated or permeated their nation that they viewed the nation as being contaminated. The whole nation. That Jewish part. Amongst the Gentile nations, it was too young yet to have made inroads so that it would be noticed to that extent. It was amongst some whose trade might be affected. Was it a coppersmith or somebody that, when his trade was threatened, he stirred up the people? But as yet, it took a little time before it came to the attention of the authorities in the way that they viewed it in the same light that the scribes and Pharisees did during our Lord's day and the Apostles' day. First part of the church. But as time went on, we find that the next trumpet affected primarily Asia Minor, where the Apostle John, his ministry, was chiefly concerned. And then we come to the third one, which is the African part of the church, those in sympathy with the African doctrine as taught by Arius, the Bishop of Alexandria. Then we come to the fourth part, which was Waldo, Peter Waldo of France. France seemed to be particularly affected with the doctrine of Protestantism. Only at that time it hadn't gotten the popularity like with Luther's day. They were referred to as nonconformists. And there was another name for them, the Waldensian movement, Waldenses. But it seemed to chiefly affect France and its environment. But now when we come to the fifth stage of the church, this doctrine, which was more or less confined to a quarter of Christendom, now began to permeate and spread abroad into other lands. And that's the remarkable thing about the Reformation in Luther's day. It began to make inroads to a large extent into other nations, like to America, to England, as well as to Germany and the Holland countries, and in Sweden, part of Holland, not just a segment of it, and in the Scandinavian countries. It began to spread out. And the church in that day, it still speaks of a third part, I think, in connection with the sixth trumpet, that when it's blown, a third part of men are slain, it says under the sixth trumpet. And that third part would be a part that's couldn't be geographically located to the extent that some of these other messages were. That in that day of the blowing of the sixth trumpet, Christianity was in three segments primarily. There was the Catholic segment and the English church segment and the other non-Orthodox churches. Composed of Baptists, Methodists, and other denominations, and that was one sphere or realm, and another was the English part, and then another was the Catholic part, and it was this independent realm, the Lutheran Church, the Methodist Church, the Baptist Church, the Scottish Presbyterian Church, that realm was affected during the blowing of the sixth trumpet. That third part. The Roman part and the English part had their experiences primarily in earlier ages. They were affected, but Italy didn't turn Protestant when the Reformation went on, and a large part of Europe didn't. There was a large part that did, there was a large part that did not, were not affected. But in this case, in the blowing of the sixth trumpet, it was much more widespread, the cause of Protestantism. And they were not just a few outcasts from the church. It grew to such an extent that they saw that they could never conquer it in their day by the stratagem that they had hoped to before Luther and his doctrine gained such a foothold in the earth. So we find that where before God had not allowed the trumpet to have the success that he allows them to have as we come nearer to their termination. You'll notice that the three last trumpets, after the fourth trumpet sound, it says that there was an eagle flying in mid-heaven, saying with a voice, "Woe to the inhabitants of the earth, by reason of the three woes that are yet to come." In other words, those three woes are identified with the fifth, sixth, and seventh trumpet. Now, the fifth trumpet had a great effect an undermining effect, as it were, the doctrine of Wycliffe in England. But it only produced a torment. It didn't produce the real Reformation. It wasn't until Luther came on the scene that the Reformation really started. Wycliffe is called the morning star of the Reformation. He paved the way for the Reformation. He had as much light as Luther had, and as much zeal. But he was so far ahead of his time that it wasn't successful in his day. But when Luther came on the scene, the taxation and other conditions in the earth, the people were beginning to be dissatisfied to such an extent. When he boldly came on the scene, he had many adherents who espoused his cause, not because they really liked the Christians or they loved the truth or as it's taught in the Bible, but they felt that here was a man that was standing for liberty. And they were in sympathy with him from that standpoint. And so he gained great political power, from backing, as it were, from these other independent princes. And so that's the second of the three woes. The fifth trumpet was the first, had an undermining influence, but the sixth trumpet, when it blew, had a great effect upon Christendom. And it produced the Reformation, the great split in Christendom. Now it mentions that in this sixth trumpet, that these four angels were prepared for a day, an hour, a month, and a year. It seems to emphasize the thought that when they are loose, it is such an exact period of time in God's time clock that it could be pinpointed as occurring at a specific moment. We had the privilege of seeing a painting, a very large painting, of the Reformation. And I bet you could guess what the artist drew to picture the Reformation and put it on canvas, one act. And what do you think he painted on that canvas? As the Reformation. If you were commissioned to say, well, when did this Reformation, to put on a canvas, when this Reformation occurred, and put the whole story in one scene, what scene would you select? the nailing to the door of the 95 Theses of Luther. Now, Luther, in previous years, had doctrinal debates within the Catholic Church, and he gained a reputation as quite a doctor of theology. But it was a thing within the fold, as it were, and it was done on the side, and he had a college at Wittenberg and gained popularity, even more so later when he manifested his boldness. But these things happened before. But when he went to this church door and did this open act, that was quite different from all the discussions that took place before. This was a public opposition to the church, to which no one even dared to do, because they would feel it would be certain excommunication and certain death. Not only death to them, but their families and their possessions and all would be lost. So it would be a great sacrifice for him to do what he did. But he did it boldly, and by doing that, from that time on, it was like striking the match. And the Great Reformation movement really started going fast thereafter. And God remarkably preserved him, although the forces of evil seemed to try to close that door on the Reformation movement. It tells that in connection with the sixth stage of the church, that Jesus says, I stand before this door and I hold it open, and no man's able to close that door. That had a particular application, that message, to Luther's day. That here was an opening of a door of hope. It's much like Pentecost, a new era, as it were, is being born. And all the forces of evil were trying to close that door. And the forces of the Reformation were small. It says, you are small. I'm just paraphrasing it, the message to the sixth church. It says, you are small, but because you have faith in me, and you've done what you did, I'm going to make sure that door is not going to close. And I'm the one that has this authority, and nobody's going to be able to close that door when I open it. And if I want to close it, nobody could open it if I wanted to close it. But it was particularly the holding of the door open that's emphasized in this particular era. And we believe that day, hour, day, month, and year was October 31st, 1517. The exact hour, I don't know. It's relatively immaterial, but we know he didn't take a couple hours putting it up there. That on that day, he just took a few moments with the hammer, whatever he used. But that was how definite that time was. And that, we believe, that God had designed and timed that to occur on that day. It wasn't that he just took and he felt pretty good that day and he chose that day. It was that's the day that God had predetermined that the Reformation was to start. So exact. Just like he had predetermined when Jesus had to die. Jesus had to die April 3rd, A.D. 33, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The Bible taught that, that God had predetermined that. And so we find that when that day came, it happened right on time. And so we think that that's the particular emphasis in connection with the sixth trumpet blowing. This is one of the things that happened at the beginning of that era. See, when these four angels, the four usually has the thought of universality, a comprehensive picture, like whether it's four winds or the four corners of the earth or the four angels which stand about God. It pictures like the four that's in Ezekiel that stand on four sides of God's throne as sentinels and as his messengers, that they can go at an instant's notice to any realm, any place on the earth at an instant's notice to carry out his wishes. So the four, covering the four points of the compass, suggests that when they were loose, that this message that was timed to be go forth at that time would not be confined within a local radius, but that would emanate and spread out into the earth. And though it says a third part only are affected, that third part is no longer, it can no longer be localized. It's a third part throughout the world. It had a wide, wide influence. The Protestant movement started by Luther in Germany and went to Switzerland. Some even have Calvin as the father of the Reformation. But I don't think that from the Bible standpoint, he is accredited as the father of the Reformation, even though many men feel that he is. We think the Lord recognized Luther primarily, but that had sympathy in Switzerland and quickly in France, parts of France, and in England, Tyndale in England. He was on the scene just about the same time Luther was, and when Luther was translating the Bible into German, Tyndale was doing the same thing into English. So we find that it's broadening out now. It's not just the Bible being printed in France like in Wycliffe's and Waldo's day, nor in Wycliffe's day. It was just the Bible in English to the common people of England. But now it's beginning to spread out into other nations. And it's within the sounding of this sixth angel that the Bible societies also, after the French Revolution, had their great being spread out into all the earth, into all the languages of the earth, so that today people can have the benefit of the Bible in their own tongue, the tongue which they can read and discuss these things with, where previously it had to be done with the church language. The Bible had to be read primarily in Latin. You could obtain it in the Greek. It was scarcer in the Greek, but you had to be more of a scholar. And you still had to be a scholar to have to be in Latin. You had to be indoctrinated through the church in order to read the Bible. But now it was brought to the hands of the people. So with this third part, we would understand to be the non-Orthodox Protestant part, not the Roman part or the English church part now primarily, but the non-Orthodox part that became contaminated in the sixth realm by Luther's doctrine. You notice that when that chapter ends, there seems to be an abrupt ending, and as though something else is introduced in the subject abruptly. That was the ninth chapter, wasn't it? The tenth chapter. I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head. His face was as it were the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. And he had in his hand a little book open, and he set his right foot on the sea, and his left on the earth, and cried with a loud voice as when a lion roars. And when he cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. And when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, I was about to write. Then he was told to seal up the things and not to utter them. This gives us a little insight as to what happened during the sounding of the sixth trumpet. And the setting of this scene has its place primarily following the French Revolution. You'll notice that when this angel puts his foot on the sea and on the land, he's stabilizing the influence in the earth. He's keeping it under control, and it was the French Revolution which threatened to overwhelm civilized earth. And just as the four angels in another chapter held back the four winds, lest they blow upon the earth and hurt the trees and the earth and the sea, they were restrained from doing that until the servants of God were sealed in their foreheads. And not until all the servants of God are sealed in their foreheads will the four winds be loosed. And that started, we believe, with the French Revolution, from right on down to our present day, right through the Harvest Movement, and even today. The winds are still being held back in this sense until the servants of our God are sealed in their foreheads. That condition was stabilized, and it would have overwhelmed the earth had not God intervened. The serpent that cast out the water as a flood from its mouth would have overwhelmed the woman had not God foreseen and made arrangements that it would have just the opposite effects that the adversary had designed. So instead of overwhelming, it came out for good. The same with the French Revolution. Instead of overwhelming France and the other nations, restraining liberties of the people even more, lest it enter their nations, they had to do the opposite policy. Instead of tightening the reins over the public, they had to loosen them. And we had republican forms of government spring up in the earth ever since the French Revolution. And so we find here that it had the opposite effect. In this chapter, we find this angel coming down and doing this and stabilizing the condition of the society below. And he tells that the setting, we believe, is just prior to the Harvest Movement and the presence of the Lord. This is not emphasizing our Lord coming in 1874, this scene. It takes just some of the details in the very setting. It tells us that this angel, when he's doing this, and he raises his hand and he swears that time shall be no longer, there's one clue there. In Daniel, you remember when we went into about the angel there who raised his hand there and said that it was only for time and half a time, that this system would be allowed to overwhelm the people, that it would be no longer, and that there were people on either side of this angel who was above the waters, and they spoke to this angel on either side, how long shall these things be? And he swore by the God of heaven, raised his right hand, said that it would be no longer, that long persecuting power would never again be permitted. If it were just for these pictures, we would see that and say that the church could never come back into power. If it were just for the pictures. But we find that there are other pictures that very clearly, just as clearly, teach it will come back into power. And there would seem to be a conflict on the surface. But when we see that the emphasis is the long crushing of oppression of the truth and the Lord's people is emphasized in that setting, then we see that this other rise of Babylon is but for an hour. It's a very short duration. And in the battle, in the 17th chapter of Revelation, it shows the Lamb is overcoming. And yet when the Lamb overcomes and wins the battle in the 17th chapter, there are many who are going to lose their lives. And from their standpoint, it might appear they're losing the battle, because it tells us many of the Lord's people will die at that time. So it seems to be defeat, but actually what seems to be defeat works for victory, because when the war is over, the kingdom is established, and the success of truth has now, the kingdom has come, and the reign of righteousness has begun. And the Lamb is shown as not losing that war. Yet it shows in that 17th chapter the beast has an hour of power right in that chapter, and yet he says he loses the war. The Lamb wins, and those with him. And yet the beast has an hour of power. It's because he has just a brief period of power that it's spoken of in that way, that the war is really lost. But that is just a little rise of power for a short duration. Now, let's see if we can get back to the subject again. We've been wandering around. This angel, when he's stabilizing the condition of the sea and the land, he tells that when the future seventh angel sounds, he says that in the days of the seventh messenger, when he shall begin to sound, that the mystery of God will be finished. It shows that he's not in that period, but that period is yet future. He's saying when this comes, when it begins to sound, this message, he's not saying it has begun to sound and I'm introducing it. It is now sounding. He puts the future. And this is in harmony with Brother Russell in the volume. He likens this angel with a little book as occurring with the Millerite movement. We read that one night. 1829 onwards, he likens this little book that was opened. And it becomes more forceful, a picture, from 1874 on, the 1335 days. But it had its beginning in this particular vision in 1829. And we were always puzzled why Brother Russell just made that brief comment. We have not found it anywhere else in his writings, yet it's in the volume, which we all read. But it harmonizes with the setting, that it's just after the French Revolution, and yet it's prior to the seventh trumpet, and it's an in-between period. And so this condition of society being held back, restrained, lest the time of trouble come prematurely, it's kept back from coming prematurely. We can't begin. You know, there's so much in these chapters that we could go over and over again and still be bringing details out. We're just trying to give suggestions to open fields of thought on the subject that can be perused at your own convenience and analyzed at a more appropriate time for yourself. Now we go back again. I'll have to more or less generalize a little bit. Oh, let's do it this way now. When the fifth trumpet sounded, that was the first woe, right? After the four trumpets had finished sounding, this angel says that three more woes are yet to come, and that is the fifth trumpet, the sixth trumpet, and the seventh trumpet. What was the woe of the fifth trumpet? A 150-day torment. A five-month torment. That was the woe of the fifth trumpet. Men were tormented for 5 months, and they stopped up.